Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's show is brought to you by Materials Security. They're a very interesting startup that has a completely different take on what email security actually is. Materials co-founder Ryan Noon will be along in this week's sponsor interview to talk about some of the stuff they're doing on the analytics side. You'd be surprised what sort of insight you can get from actually looking at a corpus of email. So that is a fun chat with Ryan Noon, and it's coming up after this week's news segment with our co-host Adam Boileau, which starts now. And Adam, of course, the big news over the last week is this whole Kaseya ransomware thing, although it's a constantly moving target. At first, it was a supply chain attack, and then we find out, well, maybe not so much. And then it was, oh my God, the biggest attack in history. And then, well, maybe not so much. I mean, for as much as we know about this whole sequence of events, there's a whole bunch more we don't know. But let's start at the beginning. It looks like what's happened here is the Reval ransomware crew have used some O'Day in Kaseya to hack into a bunch of MSSPs and push out dodgy hotfixes to the endpoints managed by those Kaseya instances. This is, I believe, why people initially thought this was a supply chain attack, because because the threat actors were pushing this stuff as like Kaseya hotfix down to the endpoints, and they thought, oh, it's a bad patch. But no, it just looks like someone actually owned the management boxes. Is that your understanding as well?
That seems to be the story, yeah. I mean, Kaseya is like a management product for, you know, managing endpoints, and, you know, has built-in ability to go out and deploy, run code, deploy patches, do whatever it likes on the machines it manages, you know, through a centralized management system. So it's a really natural place to leverage to do exactly this kind of thing. So, I mean, it's, you know, it's certainly a supply chain attack, and that they went in, you know, threw the vendor down. But that kind of double hop through a managed service provider is what's really expanded the reach. And, you know, that's a thing that we've seen plenty of other attackers do. But of course, a lot of the rhetoric around this has been about, oh my God, you know, they're using, you know, nation state technique because they thought about what they were doing and just used the tool, you know, like it's meant to be used. And then, you know, oh my God, 0 day because, well, you know, SQL injection in a bunch of ancient classic ASP scripts, which apparently is what Kaseya has written in. So yeah, it really has been rather, you know, built up to be yes, it's supply chain. Yes, it probably was 0 day. I think the bugs in question, some of the reporting suggested that Kaseya knew about the bugs and were in the process of fixing them.
Well, but and that's brought up the question of whether or not someone was in their ticketing system or something and got advanced knowledge of these bugs. But I mean, it could just be a collision given how low grade and absolutely house these bugs are, right?
Well, exactly. And I think we've even seen, I don't know if it was the same group, but we've seen other groups use Kaseya to distribute malware in the past, right? So it's certainly a product that has had some visibility. And it's kind of like, once you look at that, there's going to be a bug in the next thing over and the next thing over. And, you know, well, I remember even, 10 years ago, KiwiCon, someone gave a talk which had a bunch of Kaseya bugs in it. So, you know, it's a product that has had a pretty checkered security past. So, I mean, collision certainly seems more likely than, you know, stealing the bug out of their ticketing system. But of course, that is a thing that does happen.
Yeah, it is. Like, last year, they actually did a snake oilers slot on this show. And I'm like, oh, to my eternal shame, full disclosure. Because ultimately, there's not really many companies that make software that's as fully featured as this. But one thing I want to point out, though, is, yeah, look, you just alluded to it there, which is everyone saying, oh my God, it's O'Day. Ransomware crews are using O'Day now. And this is like nation state level apex predators. Oh, that's crazy. It's not. It's absolutely rubbish code. This is an auth bypassed in an ASP script on the web management interface. What I'm getting at is O'Day in like something like Windows SMB or IIS or whatever. Okay, that's a big deal.
Principles.
Exactly. Finding O'Day like this is not hard, which also begs the question, why the hell was it there in the first place? Like, you would think if these guys had any decent testing budget, they would have found bugs like these pretty easily.
You'd really hope so, but I mean, you know, there's a real wide range of pen testing skills out there, and, you know, whenever you go look at a vendor product, there's always bugs shake out, you know?
So why isn't that the story? Okay, this is what's driving me nuts, is I'm looking at all of these headlines calling these guys the apex predators of the internet and saying that they're using O'Day and that they're sophisticated state-level, you know, skills. Why are we talking about that and not talking about the fact that Kaseya had these bugs in it in the first place? This wasn't hard. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, these weren't hard bugs to find. Why were they there? Why are we accepting this? You know, and I know I sound like you right now talking about this. I don't think, I'm not from that school of people who thinks that software vendors should actually be liable for all flaws in their product. But if they're not doing testing, right? If they're not doing testing that should show up these sorts of bugs, well, I mean, surely liability's got to kick in at some point.
I mean, you would think so. But I mean, part of this is about, you know, is about market failure, right? If you go to any one of the vendors, you know, any vendor's website, they've all got padlocks and you know, like raining matrix text that says they care about security and take your security very seriously, etc. Everyone says that. And as a consumer, as someone buying a product, you really have no way of knowing the quality of the product that you're buying. And unless you test it as part of the procurement process, which a few people do, but when they do, inevitably we end up finding bugs that it's unbelievable that the vendor never had tested, right? I mean, it's a regular occurrence around my office, you know, that we review a vendor product, even from big name vendors, as part of the purchase process, and we find bugs. And I, you know, I don't know how a customer is meant to make an educated decision, which ends up with market failure, right? There's no pressure on these companies until now, right? Ransomware is
But hang on. This is where the pressure should be. But I'm not seeing pressure talking about Kaseya. I'm seeing pressure talking about, oh my God, these ransomware people are so diabolical. They're like APT crews with this crazy ODA. You know what I mean? Where's the pressure on Kaseya? I'm not seeing, the only pressure I'm seeing on them is Reval demanding $70 million to provide a master yes. key to decrypt everything. Because there's like three different levels of encryption with Reval. There's like the people who actually developed Reval have like a master key in case something goes wrong and an affiliate encrypts the wrong person or whatever. They can get rid of that. There's a campaign key and then there's a individual system key, right? One thing that's interesting, though, is they are demanding Kaseya pay this money, and they're saying up to 1 million boxes have been infected, but they have zero telemetry. We know that from analysis of this malware. They have no idea how much, you know, how successful this campaign's been. Indeed, we've seen reports that some antivirus software actually stopped this on the end machines. I've seen other reports saying, well, a lot of these people, they only had a few boxes with Kaseya agents on them, so it hasn't actually been that devastating. Other reports saying that it didn't really do much to hobble backups, so there's a recovery path for a lot of people there. So we really don't know how successful this campaign's been. It's going to be a while before we find out. But where's the pressure on Kaseya? Why is no one putting their feet to the fire on this? I'm just not seeing it, and it's making me a little bit crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good question. I don't know why we, you know, let all of the vendors, you know, when people are getting shelled through their VPN appliances and through their firewalls and through their, you know, remote access gateways, you know, and now management solution, managed service providers. Yeah, I mean, it's a 100% legit question to ask. But as a customer making a purchase choice, I don't know, you know, I don't know what you're going to do, really. I mean, other than pay probably more than the product costs to go have it tested.
I think it's genius, though, that these guys are ransoming Kaseya, right? Because yes. they're putting Kaseya in a really difficult position, because at this point, you know, every customer who's been caught up in this knows that Kaseya is in a position to fix this for them. Mm-hmm. So if they don't, like, it's actually kind of a bit of evil genius ransomwareing there, you know.
You know, we do love innovation in that industry, and they are, this is, you know, it's real smooth. And especially the, you know, the idea that, you know, you can use, because we've seen individual end users be, you know, used to apply pressure. We've seen media used to apply pressure, but this kind of whole thing where you attack the whole chain down and then use all of the customers to apply pressure up to the top of the supply chain, like that is real smart. And I think there's definitely some lessons to be learned here for the other ransomware operators, because I think it's a real smart play.
I think Ben Nagy actually had the best tweet on this, where he said, you know, it's the old way of thinking to call them ransomware operators. They're really, in reality, what they are is technical debt collectors.
that's some top work Nagy tweeting there.
yeah. Now, look, we know that Joe Biden is actually going to be in the Situation Room tomorrow discussing ransomware, which is pretty crazy. But, you know, you don't often go to the Situation Room to talk about how to better use the FBI. I think there's some movement at the station with regard to Hound release for sure. You know, the White House is all over this one.
Certainly the timing for 4th of July rubbed a lot of people's nose in it, I think.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen some really dumb coverage as well. There's been another attack out of Russia, government linked, that we'll talk about in a minute, that the New York Times is trying to link to this by saying it's unclear if they're related when they're clearly not related, which is just really, correlation does not equal causation, people. But yeah, there was a supermarket in Sweden, was it that closed 800 stores following this? We still can't measure the true impact though here, can we?
No, I mean, in this case, I think the point of sale systems were being managed by a third-party vendor that used Kaseya, and that was the impact for them was that they just couldn't process transactions. So they were giving away their strawberries for free, apparently. So that's one positive thing that came out of this.
Free ransomware for free strawberries.
Free awesome. Strawberries, yum, yum. But yeah, we're not going to know for a while. Like, we saw reports of like schools in New Zealand, where some third-party support vendor was using it. So there's been a few examples, but you know, a million boxes, you would think we would notice.
Yeah, you would think. But I mean, other people are saying, well, a lot of it is like small to medium businesses that have their stuff managed remote, right? Like car dealerships and dentist office and things like that. And they're not the sort of ones that typically make the news. So I just don't know if we're ever going to know what the impact is here. Now, look, let's talk about this print spooler bug, because this one's been kind of lost in the noise. We actually spoke about this bug last week, but I cut it for space because at that time, we didn't know that the patch for this bug didn't work, but the patch doesn't work. So it turns out there's basically an unpatched bug in Windows which gives you PrivEsc, which is, less than ideal. I mean, there'd be a lot of people out there with user-level access into a Windows domain who would be using this to go crazy right now.
Oh, yeah. Like, this bug is real juicy. And, of course, it comes from a long lineage of Windows print spooler bugs. Essentially, the guts of the bug is that as a regular user, for some dumb reason, you can like deploy a new printer and then you can tell it where the drivers come from and then supply your own drivers, which then get run as privileged user on the print spooler, which in many cases could be a domain controller. Yay. You can do that over the network, which is kind of what people are doing here. And the funny thing was that a proof of concept for this got dropped by some, I think, Chinese researchers. They posted it on their GitHub by accident, thinking the bug was patched like we did.
Yeah.
And then realized, actually, no, it's not patched, pulled it off. But by that point, the code was out of the bag.
Because like that was last week when we spoke about it. It's like, yeah, they published a POC and then pulled it. That's weird, but it's a patched bug. And then, yeah. Next minute.
Turns out not so much patch. So Microsoft's been scrambling around. This also affects like all of the Windows versions, and I think there's even support in Mimikatz now for doing printer stuff like this. And yeah, the fact you can do it across the network is also bad. And like, I'm not even, we saw early reports that it was like only affecting domain controllers, but that I don't believe is the case anymore. You can hit all sorts of other boxes on the network with it. And it's a real bad, juicy bug. And as you say, like the number of people who have an initial foothold and want to get, domain admin in a domain is essentially everybody. There's going to be a lot of use of this around. And Microsoft is still scrambling, I believe, to get the patch. I saw some reports on Twitter that there were patches and then the links were forwarding. And either way, it's a real mess for everybody at the moment.
It is. I mean, you just got to love the July 4th week in the US when something always happens and it's always a disaster. But there we go. What do we got here? Yeah, so NSA published a bunch of information on some dumb hacking that Russia's doing. But, as you often say, Adam, it's not dumb if it works. And spinning up brute forcing clusters in Kubernetes is apparently what GRU's been doing lately.
Very innovative, yes. Now, we've seen reports that, widespread account brute forcing, which obviously has been going on for a while, but, the fact that they still find success with this technique, I guess, is the point that that they're trying to make. I did think this was a really funny juxtaposition, though, of, oh my God, ransomware crews are using nation state technique with supply chain attacks, and then nation states are using brute force, against Office 365.
That's a good point. It doesn't take much to roll like a nation state actor.
Exactly. But it's good. THC Hydra from the 90s, yeah.
It's good to see this sort of stuff being kicked out of NSA, though. I mean, I even got the email offering me, an embargoed release. Obviously,
password brute forcing.
Well, obviously, by the time I replied, it was out of their business hours anyway, I didn't wind up getting it, and they delayed it anyway. But it is good that they're talking about this stuff. I appreciate this new transparency, which, you and I have been doing this a long time, and 10 years ago, we wouldn't have seen anything like this kicking out of NSA.
Yeah, no, exactly. It is really good. And it's a good reminder for people that, all of the important stuff, multi-factor auth and password controls and detective controls, all of that stuff does actually buy you something. Like, it's not just, zero-day sexy bugs that, need your attention, right? Basic hygiene is still important. And, if it's good enough for the Russians, then, hey, it's good enough for everybody.
I think it's funny that they're using Kubernetes and they don't have the skills to build a proper brute forcing app. Something that scales without Kubernetes.
Lol. Savage.
Cernovich.
More Russia stuff. Apparently, now this is a story that's breaking at the moment. The details are as clear as mud. But the headline from Bloomberg says that Russia's cozy bear breached the GOP as ransomware attack hit. And we've also seen subsequent coverage from the New York Times. The basic story here seems to be that a third-party supplier to the Republican National Committee did get itself owned by the same group that carried out the SolarWinds stuff. And, you know, they're making a big deal out of it. But the RNC, for its part, is sort of shrugging and saying, well, we don't know anything about this, which makes you wonder if, and the third party is Synnex Corporation, which I believe is a bit of a distributor and reseller of all sorts of things. They're the ones who apparently got breached. So I guess maybe some of their incident responders are talking to the press and saying, well, we know that the RNC was targeted before the RNC knows. But as I say, this story is as clear as mud. We don't really have any details here, but the US press is sort of going into overdrive about this, saying it's a big challenge to Joe Biden, it's Putin thumbing his nose, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, reading between the lines of the reporting, you know, you can kind of imagine, you know, company gets compromised, they have access to a bunch of their customers, you know, Microsoft environments for whatever reason, and then, you know, attacker would break in and then use that access to try and, you know, see what else they can discover inside customer team, in Microsoft 365, et cetera, environments. And we've seen these attackers do that with SolarWinds, right? They would break into people that had access and then go up into the Microsoft cloud. So you can kind of see that happening. And if they had a bunch of customers and one of them happens to be the RNC, and as you say, like an incident responder or someone gets to talking, you can kind of see how those dots would get joined together. It does seem like Microsoft has been involved as well. So maybe there was some degree of unusual access or something from Synnex up into RNC's Microsoft environment that got blocked. So it is a little bit unclear, but certainly fits a pattern that we've seen in other environments, you know, of going up into, you know, unrelated, well, up into a Microsoft environments that, you know, the third party has some degree of access to, and then using that to try and pivot onwards. So, but yeah, we don't really know yet. And as you say, the press is certainly having a field day with it in the US.
Yeah, they really are. I want to read to you an excerpt, a very short excerpt from the take on this from the New York Times. And this just blows my mind. I mean, people who listen to this show regularly would have heard me describe the New York Times cyber coverage as quote unquote bad. This is just another example of this. Listen to this from the New York Times. The RNC attack was the second of apparent Russian origin to become public in the last few days, and it was unclear late Tuesday whether the two were related. What on earth? Like, is there a single data point linking these two things, or is it just everything that comes out of Russia?
Russia.
You know?
It's all Russia.
Oh, man.
The Red Menace.
It's brain worms. Like, honestly, that I was just really surprised to read that. Anyway. What do we got? We got Chinese doing some trash hacking against the Afghan National Security Council. I mean, you probably wouldn't need to bring your A game to target a developing country like Afghanistan. But yeah, we got a bit of a write-up here from Catalan at The Record.
Yeah, talking about attacks here against the National Security Council impersonating like the president's office. Which, you know, hey, why not? You know, if you're going to go, you know, social engineering, you may as well go with someone who's got some authority. But yeah, pretty standard issue Chinese techniques, and the, you know, malware looks like it's been used by a bunch of previous campaigns. But hey, if it gets the job done, right?
And some shady business in Mongolia. This is a great story. I mean, it's depressing, it's terrible, as hell. But yeah, someone with some front. Talk us through what happened to the official Mongolian certificate authority, Adam.
So because the Mongolian Certificate Authority requires you to install a CA certificate, you know, because they're not in the trust stores of the operating systems and the browsers in the first place, you are supposed to at some point go and download and install these certificates with an installer from Monpass, one of the largest certificate authorities in Mongolia. Anyway, somebody, persons unknown who I'm sure don't share a land border, logged into that and appended a small Cobalt Strike generated backdoor to the certificate installer, so that everybody in Mongolia who used that, presumably every time you install a new system, you have to go do that. Yeah, they got themselves backdoored. So that's, I mean, that's certainly a bit of, that's a pretty big middle finger right there in the National Certification Authority. And I do know, this is not even the first time. We saw, I think it was the Vietnamese government cert authority had the same thing. And then there was that...
the Myanmar
font,
stuff.
The font, with the font packers yeah, from yeah, Myanmar. Yeah. And like, what do these three countries have in common?
Jeez, I wonder. Now, look, this Kaseya thing has gotten all of the attention over the last week, right? So this next story that we're going to talk about has kind of slid under the radar a bit. There's an Israeli private investigator who's been detained in New York since 2019 on charges of involvement in a hacker-for-hire scheme. Now, we got a story here written by Rafael Satter, Chris Bing, and Joel Shetman over at Reuters about this. What's really interesting here is this guy is almost certainly linked to that Beltrox group operating out of India, and he's just agreed to make a plea deal. Right? Now, I don't know if you remember, but this whole Beltrox stuff, like there was a lot of noise at the time that they were targeting environmental activists on behalf of like big oil companies and stuff like that. And now we're looking at a possible supergrass who's going to spill. I mean, this guy, apparently he's linked to like hacking for hedge funds or something like that. Like we haven't heard much mention of the activist side of it, but this guy almost certainly knows where the bodies are buried. I spoke to Chris Bing about this and asked him to tell us a bit more about this story. And here's what he said.
So over the last year, our reporting team at Reuters has been following this really peculiar criminal case out of the Southern District of New York concerning a jailed private detective from Israel called Aviram Azari. The reason that we have cared about this story is because the case of Aviram Azari is about the underground hacking community from India, this kind of mercenary industry that offers hacking services to high net worth individuals and private detectives. The Aviram case is really amazing in a way because it offers this rare window into this industry and the players and victims. When the Southern District brought this case last year, we knew that a series of New York companies had been hacked, and our question was always who was commissioning the hacking or who was the end client that was interested in hacking these companies. Now, the most recent update has been that Aviram appears to be ready to enter into plea negotiations with the Southern District. And, you know, this could have really big repercussions for this entire underground mercenary hacking industry. And it's just going to be pretty amazing to see what comes out of it.
So this, you know, definitely falls into the one to watch category, don't you think?
Yeah, no, it certainly does. Because, I mean, that Beltrox thing was always, you know, we didn't get a whole bunch of info at the time and it seemed interesting, but there was just very little to go on. And so, yeah, if this ends up getting kind of cracked wide open and we see, you know, obviously having some good journos pulling the threads on the story, yeah, it's going to be fun to see what comes out of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Reuters team really did a good job of like cracking the door open a little bit on that and gave us a bit of a peek inside. And it was like, oh my God, there's really something there. But, you know, we've been waiting for more details to come, but we might be about to get them. I hope so anyway. Zach Whitaker over at TechCrunch has a write-up here on some research done by Forensic Architecture, which is an academic unit at Goldsmiths University of London. And what they've done is they're trying to link NSO spyware to actual physical violence against people like activists. It's, you know, I think this looks like really important work.
So the researchers went around and talked to a bunch of people who've had the NSO spyware on their devices, you know, journalists and activists and all sorts of people, and then correlated that with other reports of, you know, violence against them and their, you know, families and extended networks and other sorts of, you know, sort of real world intimidation to try and build a set of data. And they've got like a couple of, I think 1,000 or so people in the data set to try and get linked together, you know, activists in a particular country being victimized by the software, but then also showing how that ties together with the other things that are being done to them, you know, in the wider context. Because, you know, it's very easy as nerds to get tied up in just the you know, the cyber computer side of it. But it's when you see it laid out, and they've got some kind of graphs that show timelines of, you know, kind of cyber activity versus real world activity.
Yeah.
And it kind of makes it a bit clear when you see it laid out. You know, here's a group of journalists in a particular country like Mexico, and here's instances of their phones being compromised, and here's instances of their, you know, them being harassed in the real world or their, you know, families' homes or whatever else. Like, it does kind of draw that picture of the use of this software as part of systemic you know, kind of oppression and violence against these people, which, you know, NSO presumably has a bunch of other customers that, you know, perhaps use the software in the ways that they claim it's used. But this kind of data set's really important when you're arguing against that position.
Yeah, I mean, even if your position is they're not careful enough, it's important to be able to show why.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. We got an interesting thing here, which is Microsoft executives kind of blowing the whistle here a little bit on excessive government demands for data under sort of secretive subpoenas, Adam.
Yeah, so this was a statement from Tom Burt, Microsoft's Vice President of Customer Security and Trust, who was testifying in front of the House Judiciary Committee. And he said that Microsoft is being subject to something in the order of, you know, 2,500 to 3,500 secrecy orders a year, which prevent them from talking about cases where government have showed up with a warrant and asked them to hand over some data, and Microsoft's not allowed to then go and tell the customers that that has happened, which... Given the kind of rapid movement of businesses and individuals into Microsoft's cloud environment, and of course other cloud providers, you can extrapolate probably the same sorts of things happen to the others as well. You know, that's potentially, you know, especially when the warrants that authorize this, you know, because they're not necessarily so visible because of the secrecy orders, can be kind of flimsy. And Microsoft's arguing that these are pretty flimsy. They're being authorized without a whole bunch of, you know, kind of effective oversight from the judges issuing, you know, the very bland warrants, and then the secrecy orders making it difficult to have an informed debate about the whole thing. And that's, you know, I think that is probably a concern to a lot of people who don't necessarily think about, you know, who has access to their data. And, you know, the parallel to our concern about how data is handled by Chinese companies, you know, for everybody who isn't in the US, a corporation like Microsoft, where, you know, all around the world we're using their software, you know, our exposure to US jurisdiction, for example, may be a little bit unclear as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think one interesting thing here is this is a conversation that probably wouldn't be happening without the Snowden disclosures. You know, they did have, in some ways, a positive effect. I believe that there were certainly some very negative effects there as well. But, you know, it is a positive when you've got this case where Microsoft is worried enough about its reputation that it feels it needs to kind of blow the whistle on this sort of activity, which they wouldn't have felt previously. You know, just knowing that it could come out eventually anyway means they kind of need to get ahead of it and lodge their protest. You know?
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a very good point around our awareness and understanding of how governments can leverage their own access, you know, to third-party data, to companies, the whole data. Yeah, it's important that, you know, our understanding of that has changed as a result of Snowden and a bunch of the other stuff since then. But, I mean, that combined with the really accelerated move into centralized computing and away from distributed stuff, you know, it's a thing we need to be reminded of, I think, that what that means in terms of who has access to what.
And wrapping up some decent oversight around that stuff is probably a good thing to do if you're going to continuously throw shade at, like, China's national security laws that insist that they compromise, you know, that they cooperate.
Exactly, right? Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, you know, if you were China, if Chinese government, I mean, Microsoft looks like a way bigger threat than Huawei does to us, you know?
Yeah, exactly. The Dutch police, meanwhile, have taken down DoubleVPN, which is apparently like a shady VPN service that all sorts of cyber crooks were using.
Yes, the Dutch police apparently, quote, used their hacking powers to penetrate the VPN service and take it down.
I think they mean legal powers, not like, you know, awesome hacking power.
Elite O'Day. But no, they took out the VPN service. It was obviously used by a lot of crims. The VPN service claimed that it had no logs. The Dutch police say that they have seized some logs. So whether there's useful data in there, how long they've been in there, we don't really know. But yes, I mean, the Dutch police kind of proving their continued ability to go after, you know, just all of the workaday bits of this crime infrastructure and, you know, help themselves to it.
Now, what does the United States government and an elephant have in common, Adam?
I don't know what
they don't forget, because this poor fella here, a Romanian named Mihai Ionut Paunescu, has been arrested in Colombia. He's been wanted since 2013. They couldn't extradite him, but yeah, he has been now scooped up in Latin America, and he's going to get extradited to the United States for involvement in the Gozi malware. This is historical activity.
Yeah, this is some pretty old school, you know, banking Trojan malware from way back in the old days. This guy was involved in, I think, writing and supporting the hosting environment that was being used back then. He got arrested in Romania way, way back, and then they didn't extradite him. And I guess, yeah, he's taken his money and headed off to Latin America, because that's what you do when you're a retired Romanian criminal. But yes, bad times for him. Going to go down for something that, yeah, seems almost quaint by modern standards. End user banking malware, geez.
Yeah, yeah. Victimless crime, really, compared to modern standards. Paige Thompson. Yeah. Now, this is interesting. Paige Thompson was is, of course, alleged to be responsible for the breach of Capital One back, when was that, in 2019. She is now looking at a whole bunch more charges. Now, what makes the Paige Thompson case interesting, of course, is that I don't believe there was any allegation that she was doing this activity for profit or anything like that. This is proper, like, a bit funny in the head hacking for hacking's sake. And, yeah, it turns out she'd been quite busy.
Yes. Investigators have been going through her disk stash after they raided their place. And apparently she had something like, 20 terabytes worth of data stashed. And they've been going through it, trying to figure out who it belonged to. And yes, they've added a whole bunch of extra companies, organizations to the list of charges that she is alleged to have hacked into. You know, there's some telco providers and a DRM company and some like call center people and educational institutes. But, you know, given her modus operandi of using her knowledge of AWS environments, I imagine there's probably quite a lot of S3 bucket scraping going on, and you know,
maybe, but she did have that technique with the abusing the AWS like legacy metadata service, yeah, or something, right? So, you know, I wouldn't just assume that this is S3 bucket scraping, because that's not the sort of stuff that usually results in a federal indictment.
Yes. So either way, whatever she did, she has a lot of it kicking around. And perhaps shouldn't have bragged about it on Twitter quite so much. But yeah, she is certainly facing quite a lot more charges than she was.
I mean, I still just think, you know, what do you do with someone like this who really is, you know, who's a pain in the ass, but not a menace? Do you know what I mean? Like, what do you do with someone like Paige Thompson? You know, if you can convince them to actually, you know, use their skills to the benefit of us all, you know, by doing some sort of community service for law enforcement, I don't know. I mean, Julian Assange did that back in the day, so, you know, that didn't work out. But what do you do with someone like Paige Thompson, you know? Because this isn't ransomware, this isn't hacking for profit. This is just like, you have a weird personality. Like, what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very good question to ask. And certainly throwing people like that in jail is just going to put them in contact with more criminals and, you know, kind of help them upskill the criminal world or get coerced into stuff. Like, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, a lot of history of, you know, hacker kids being sent to jail, and it, you know, in the end for society is not a net benefit. So, yeah, I mean, having the idea of hacker community service makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I mean, of course, you work with Alastair McGibbon, who is formerly of the Australian Federal Police, and him and his colleagues always described prisons here as crime universities, is what his colleagues would call them. So, yeah. Although a little bit of a different mentality in the United States as opposed to, you know, it's more about punishment, less about interdiction. But anyway, now, look, there's been this huge kerfuffle over the last week about Microsoft releasing Windows 11, but it will only work on hardware that support, like, that has a hardware TPM. Is that right? Because that's got everyone freaking out.
That seems to be what the reporting is saying. Microsoft released a tool that was supposed to be able to kind of tell you whether your hardware was compatible or not, and then it didn't really work particularly well because there was quite a bit of nuance in, like, do you have the TPM? Is it turned on? Is it configured? Does the BIOS, you know, the motherboard vendor correctly configure it in the BIOS? Can you turn it on? There's a bunch of nuance there, but yes, a lot of people do, you know, have concerns about, you know, the massive fleet of old hardware out there that, you know, may never get Windows 11 without a TPM. And Microsoft's had some kind of dodgy stats that, like, having it, you know, using security controls like this would prevent 60% of you know, malware or hacking or some dumb thing like that, security threats, which clearly is kind of a bogus made up stat, which is not really helping the conversation. You know, there are plenty of places where having TPM backed, you know, secure, bootable, good disk crypto makes sense, but
You know what might cut down on hacking is, like, actually properly patching their software, and I don't know, like, giving people logs outside of E5. This is the thing that drives me nuts about. It drives me nuts about Microsoft that they've turned E5 into their $10 billion profit center or whatever, you know? Like, they're just, God, it's just, they are not our friend. Yeah. They are really not our friend. But that said, I think, you know, basically dropping support for hardware that doesn't have a TPM, at some point you got to do it. And Windows 10, it's not that old. It's not that creaky yet. I mean, it's probably got some life in it beyond, you know, it's got some life in it for a few more years yet, you'd think.
Yeah, so I mean, the end of the supported life's what, 2025 is when the end of Windows 10, which, I mean, you know, it's a while off in internet time, but you know, given the life cycle of hardware and, you know, I'm thinking like point of sale terminals and stuff that are still running. Like, it's the only supported Windows XP variant is the point of sale one. So, I mean, the stuff does last a long time. And I think, you know, Windows 10 will also survive beyond its 2025.
Yeah, they always announce some end of life date and then it gets stretched and stretched and stretched and stretched. So,
yeah. And I think, you know, we will probably see that. I mean, Windows 10 is destined to be the kind of XP, you know, in the sense that it will last for a very, very long time because there's so much installed base. And, you know, we probably will see a bit more nuance in this whole TPM conversation as it gets kind of further towards that.
Yep, indeed. Moving on, and look, I just, this isn't the sort of stuff we normally cover, but I just thought it was really interesting, right? Because Google kicked out a bunch of apps out of its app store that had apparently siphoned off 5.8 million Facebook passwords. Well, those apps had 5.8 million downloads and were capable of stealing Facebook passwords, I think is the more accurate way to say that. What I find really interesting about this is these apps were real apps that did actual real useful stuff. And obviously the app publishers, you know, their whole motivation, their whole monetization strategy was just to build these useful apps that people would use, but they would also steal Facebook creds, right? So it gives us an insight into life finds a way, as our sponsor guest this week will tell you. And it's just a great example of how this whole, you know, attacking at scale Facebook creds and messenger scams and whatever, you know, it's just an insight into a part of that whole life cycle, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was a pretty smart scam in the sense that these apps, as you say, they were useful apps and they had a bunch of advertising, and you could turn the advertising off if you logged into your Facebook account. I think that was the deal. And so, of course, people are incentivized to go, you know, sign up and log in. And then the thing would just kind of scrape the creds as they were entering them into the legit, you know, Facebook login portal, which is a pretty low friction way of doing it. And of course, you know, building a mobile app that does something useful is not super difficult. It's not a huge investment. So
yeah, but getting them downloaded millions of times, I mean, you know, God, with that track record, do up a resume and you get a job in marketing.
I know, exactly. It's a useful, you know, useful set of skills that will transfer into other areas of the industry. So, you know, good job, whoever it was.
Oh, we got another Microsoft bug here that I just thought was, you know, interesting enough to talk about. It's a universal cross-site scripting flaw exploitable through like some sort of translate feature. Talk us through this one, Adam.
Yeah, so this is some bug bounty kid found a bug in the translate feature of Microsoft Edge, whereupon if you ran a website through the translate feature, you could trigger cross-site scripting in the resulting page. Because obviously the translate thing, you know, scrapes the contents out of the page, runs it through Microsoft's translate API, then rebuilds the web content, the HTML content, and then presents it back to the browser. So through a bug in the translate thing, you could cause a reflected cross-site scripting that wasn't vulnerable in the actual site, but was vulnerable when it was run through Translate, and all you had to do was convince a user to do that. And there was some proof of concepts, like using YouTube, for example, with a YouTube commented in another language to then trigger cross-site scripting, which of course now has access to YouTube cookies and onwards to Google account compromise. So this kind of universal XSS is really, really bad. Because it bypasses the key control of having, you know, kind of separation in your browser. And yeah, having it in a core feature, like not in a plugin, not in some stupid add-on, yeah, not great.
No, I mean, and that example too of a YouTube comment where it's like, you know, all you need to do is get someone to click on the translate button and you've got them. Like that's, it's pretty good stuff. They got 20K for this, so I can see why.
Yeah, it's a 20K bounty. Seems a bit stingy actually to me for a universal cross-site script. I mean, if they did have one of those in Chrome, I imagine.
But that's because you're a high roller, Adam. That's because you're a high roller. Oh, now again, how many times versions of this story? So we've seen Parler. We've seen Gab, like every time someone tries to spin up one of these like alt-right Twitter clones. And it was really funny too, because I remember when this first kicked off, you would often say like they're going to have security problems. They're guaranteed not to be doing it right. And every time you were proved right. There's another one called Getter, and it's obviously with no ER, it's G-E-T-T-R. This is a social media platform that's been spun up by people closely associated with Donald Trump. And it's buggy as hell and not very good. And someone's already scraped it. Yay.
Yeah, a bunch of people have been rummaging around, figuring out how the APIs work and have done things like be able to figure out email addresses associated with accounts which are not public in the site and be able to scrape it for content, all that kind of thing. I mean, it's, as you say, it's a pretty normal set of mistakes for people to make when they're building, you know, any kind of complicated service. But, you know, we've seen even things that are not super, you know, impressive from a technical perspective, like just being able to scrape content. You know, we saw that with Parler being used used when, you know, the storming of the Capitol happened to go and map out all the people who are posting pictures. So there's a lot of useful work when, you know, you have a community that's kind of self-selected, you know, bunch of nut jobs, and then you can go scrape all their content and keep an eye on them. So, I mean, even when it's, you know, not technical bugs, there's still a bunch of useful research to be done. And, you know, if they will stand up a dumb platform, then it's going to happen.
It's really been quite an interesting 4 or 5 years for us as non-Americans covering this stuff, because I know I'm going to get an email because you just described users of that platform as nut jobs, right? But when you think about it, like anyone outside of the United States looking at your typical Parler user, they're nut jobs.
Yes.
But it's just been, it's been so weird, you know, it's been so weird. You know, you're a New Zealander in New Zealand, I'm an Australian in Australia, and it's just been so weird to cover this stuff. And I wince every time you say something like that because, yeah, the inevitable all caps email is coming, my friend. I promise.
Right there to the editorial at.
Oh, thanks. Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
We're going to close out this week's show with...
skateboarding dog story.
Skateboarding dog story this week is Kaspersky's password manager. I mean, talk us through this one.
Kaspersky have a password manager, which is good because obviously storing your passwords in a password manager is a useful thing to do. It will also generate passwords for you, which is useful, you know, so you can have unique passwords for every site. Someone dug into the password generation scheme that Kaspersky's password manager uses, and, you know, it generates random passwords. Unfortunately, the random number generator is seeded with the system time. Which means that every Kaspersky user in the world, if they click the generate button at exactly the same time, would get the same password. And that there is one password for every second, you know, I think it was second resolution on the time that they were using to see the random number generator. Sorry, there's like a finite number of passwords that a Kaspersky user will have ever picked. So that's pretty funny. And so someone's written a script that will generate all possible Kaspersky password manager passwords. So if you want the new cracking dictionary, then off you go. The extra funny sting in the tail is that occasionally a bug in the password generation scheme would actually include uninitialized memory. So you got a little bit of extra entropy sometimes.
So it's sort of like a Heartbleed password manager edition.
Oh dear. So yes, that's pretty funny. Kaspersky have pushed out a patch for it. You may want to regenerate your passwords if you were using it. Oh dear.
I mean, it's obviously less than ideal, but I still don't think this is, and it's obviously a boneheaded way to do things and obviously a mistake, but I doubt this is going to introduce much real world risk, given that, you know, most online services these days, important ones at least, they're pretty good at locking you out once you've, you know, got the password wrong 10 times, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it is more a comedy bug than one that would genuinely get you a bunch of shells, but still, like, it's pretty funny and illustrative of the things that you can get wrong when you use random number generators badly.
Indeed. Well, Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. Thank you so much for joining me to talk through all of that. It's been a real pleasure, and we'll do it all again next week.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. Talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau of CyberCX there with a chat about the week's security news. Big thanks to him for that. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Noon, the co-founder and chief executive of Material Security. So Material, I find them very interesting. They're an email security company, but certainly not on the anti-malware and anti-spam side. Basically, they spin up infrastructure for you to store your cloud email in. And then from there, their software can do stuff like redact sensitive information from your email spool, then put that redacted content back in your cloud, in your users' cloud accounts, and only allow you to remove the redactions if you do something like an MFA challenge. So that way, if someone, you know, bad gets access to one of your user accounts, they can't really do much once they're there. They can even do stuff like intercept password reset emails. So an attacker who compromises an email inbox can't reset passwords, which is great. There's a whole bunch of different use cases. But what we're talking about today is actually more on the analytics side. It turns out there's a lot you can do as a vendor once you're plumbed into an enterprise's email tenant and their MFA, right? So you can spot MFA gaps, or you can see which online services your users are subscribed to. It seems crude, but those services, things like Dropbox, they're always spamming their users. So the data is there. So there's an opportunity there to do a bunch of sensible analytics work, which it turns out is what Material does in its base tier. So here is Ryan Noon, the co-founder and chief executive of Material Security, discussing that. Enjoy.
The easiest way for us to roll out and to show value at a big customer is to just kind of turn it on in read-only mode at, you know, on a bunch of accounts or groups. And so you're pulling in essentially, read-only access to certain emails going back like a year or two for, you know, analyzing what email is at risk of being lost and what's not there. But you're also pulling in like all the Microsoft setting information, like security alerts that Microsoft and Google are giving you that you're probably ignoring. We even will pull in like SSO and MFA configuration from like third-party stuff that people are using, like a Okta or Duo or OneLogin or something like that. So it's just the core systems for protecting email and the apps that are authenticating to get at it. And we're just literally building a data warehouse, like a modern cloud data warehouse full of all this stuff, and doing a bunch of canned analysis on it that is always useful at every customer you roll it out to. So the kinds of things that you show people after you just get the data in one place is like, you know, is MFA broken anywhere? You know, is, you know, are there stuff in, you know, obvious PCI and HIPAA violations that are sitting in email? There's like, you need a good analytics product sitting under this stuff. And so the very opening phase of any one of our customer engagements is just like, is it set up the way you thought it was, you know, and do you have like reasonable visibility into stuff that you sure as hell hope is not happening in the environment, like massive personal account usage, for example?
Quite often when I talk to startups like yours, those ancillary benefits are a little more than the cherry on top quite often, right? Like, because there's not too many product categories I can think of where you are pulling in that information in order to really do something with it, like in an applied way. So there might, you might be pulling in feeds of this stuff just to store it somewhere, but you need to slice and dice that stuff to actually enable your service, which means you are going to see that sort of stuff, which it's kind of like a side benefit, right?
Yeah, no, there's always like a conceptual split between like what you know and what you do about it, or like the visibility that you have and the controls that you have in place around that. And like my big pet peeve in the security industry is that people sell one, but not the other one. Usually they'll be like, hey, here's a firewall that can block everything and whatever, but you don't know like where to use it. Or, hey, here's something that's going to scan everything and generate a bunch of alerts. I hope you're listening to them. You know, like, good enough security products are basically beepers, and it like just endlessly makes me upset. Most security products are either like, you know, beep, 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 like insecure thing detected, like hope someone gives a shit, or like, you know, insane set of controls that are totally impossible and impractical to use in a sane way.
But that's the thing. The beep, beep, beep thing is the beep, beep, beep thing is real. But I mean, there's a whole art around, you know, I mean, that's what blue teamers do, right? Is they figure out how to actually do something with the beep, beep, beep. But you're right. Standalone products aren't, you know, they're not usually applying good analysis to the data that they have access to.
But like, I think there's harmony between them. As in, I think people's imaginations as security product people, it ends at the beep, beep, beep. And then you have, well, I need a thing to take the things going beep and create meta alerts on them or something. Like, what if like instead of MFA, for example, we said, oh, I'm just going to alert you whenever someone reuses a password on different sites so that you can go and change it. That's very practical, right, Pat? Like, you'll reach out and you'll have them change their password because I've alerted you that they're reusing it. Or I could do something like MFA where like, you know what? Get them to change it, but like, you're not dead if they don't.
And this is the thing. Before we started recording this, you were telling me about some of the stuff you were finding when you deployed in new environments, and MFA gaps are something that you see quite a lot in places where you wouldn't expect to see them. Talk us through like what you've observed and like how that happened.
Oh yeah, no. I mean, you have to basically like work backwards from the data and the risk that you're actually worried about. So one of the simple things that we do is we just go and like, you know, interrogate the underlying MFA platforms, you know, via their APIs after we roll out. Sometimes it's built into Microsoft and Google, sometimes it's not. And sometimes it's just straight up broken. Like somehow people can log in some totally like jacked up configuration and it's still working. Or there's like, you know, the physical help desk, I got locked out of my account process that they had before COVID never got updated. So they've been issuing people like temporary codes that are not actually temporary that people presumably have like, you know, taped to their monitor now.
Yeah.
And, one like, time, no MFA,
you know? One time like, passwords that don't expire. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, oh, like life, or APIs that people don't even know about that are turned on.
I mean, you know, okay, so this is another thing you mentioned earlier, right? And I mean, it's long been understood that there are many mail protocols that don't support 2FA, right? So, and people forget to disable them and don't realize they do this huge Okta thing, and then they don't realize that everyone's grabbing their mail through POP, right? Because that's just a thing that's been happening. So that's been a long-standing problem. But there are even other protocols and other APIs beyond the ones that we mostly know about. Talk to us about them.
Yeah, I mean, this always happens in the wild with customers. And so we had a large customer that, they just didn't realize that they had, I think the specific one was AWS in Microsoft, right? There's the Exchange Web Services. It can bypass MFA in certain circumstances. And they didn't know that they had it turned on because Microsoft has a pretty broad product surface and will totally probably upsell you to E5 to even show you the alert that you have this turned on, you know, in the first place. There was like some super hit mail app that was totally exfiltrating stuff. I didn't even know, you know, it's just like life finds a way. It always does. It's someone's going to growth hack their way into stealing your shit. Even if it's not like the SolarWinds people, like, you know, the data is valuable. And, you know, even something that blew my mind is I was setting up a Delta airline ticket, and like the add to calendar button literally does a Google API OAuth to get full read and write access to your entire calendar instead of just using the link that like adds it. And so, and that got passed through Google's like, you know, API sensitive scope review thing that they actually put all the apps through. Like they tried to get rid of all the data farmers. And you don't really need to do that to put something on someone's calendar. That's not how it works.
No, you do not. That's wild. Which airline did you say that was?
It was Delta.
So when you book a ticket with Delta and you click add to calendar, you're giving them full access to you. Man, that's...
Full read and write access to your entire Google calendar. And this is especially bad in Microsoft land. Like, you usually hear the term like OAuth phishing, right? Like, it's really easy to make an app and users will click on basically anything. And they've only been trained to not type in their password, not click through on some app that looks like just a sign-in. You know,
What are you doing with OAuth apps? Because it was my understanding that, you know, you solved the front door access problem and OAuth is kind of like the side door, and that was a bit of a blind spot for you. Or are you doing stuff around that now?
Oh, I mean, in a lot of cases, our favorite failure mode with most of our advanced features is like, you know, someone is in your account and it doesn't matter how. Like, if you remember the leak prevention stuff that we do, it's literally taking the data out of the mailbox and only putting it back in when we know it's safe, which means that fails safe. If you accidentally OAuth someone on your entire mailbox, like, since we've actually removed the sensitive information and we're replacing it on demand when you retrieve individual pieces, the vast majority of the corpus isn't there.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's like, but leaving
they could,
your laptop
they could open, maybe right? snag mail as it comes in, right? Like that's the issue there.
Right. Totally. But like, you just got to monitor this stuff and shut it off. And
well,
like,
I'm just curious, right? Because there are ways to do that, right? Through Microsoft standard tooling. They don't make it easy, but you can do it. And there's ways to put some controls on that. But what I'm going to ask you is whether or not you're sort of monitoring that as part of your advanced features, or if that's on the roadmap, because that would make...
It's actually even in our base tier. Like, what blows my mind is like people charge, like, sucking in data. Storage is cheap. Like, we were, you know, we're big data people as much as we're security people. I used to run like analytics at Dropbox and stuff. Like, the storage and the running queries on it is cheap if you do it right. But a lot of the security industry, like, the data stuff is hard. You know, like, people have been trained by like Splunk to like pay way too much for analytics. And so our base tier is like, we're just sucking in all this stuff because, you know, it might as well show people all the OAuth apps and all the other random stuff that's going on. And then for us, the end user facing features and the like more complex kinds of protections, those are the things that, you know, are extra. If we have used our base tier where we show you the analytics, if we've made you care with the data about solving this specific advanced tricky problem, then you can, you know, basically buy that protection feature a la carte. And I think that's like the most honest way to sell this. Like, the visibility is the base. And like, if I can't make you care with the analytics, then I don't deserve, you know, your purchase for the add-on.
It's no,
like,
I mean, there's, I can think honest. Of a, I can think of a few companies that do that, which is like, we'll give you the audit for cheap, but, you know, if you want the instrumentation part, you know, you have to pay for that, which sounds, you know, fair, to be honest. So I think, I mean, that's interesting, right? That you've actually built that in so that you got visibility into OAuth across accounts. I think the one thing that's still a bit spooky when it comes to all of that OAuth stuff is when you're talking about the big deal, like service account style OAuth stuff that gets access to all mailboxes. Well, it's not really OAuth at that point, but you know what I mean.
Oh, it's OAuth in Microsoft. It's not in Google, though. Google does the domain-wide delegation stuff. It's why you have to really hyper audit your super admins a lot on O365 deployments, because in one click, they can give everything. Like, you know, it's exactly the same flow that we use to onboard a new Office 365 tenant. You just have the super admin say yes. So it is the most consequential click that I think anybody can do, short of like the people doing the Hawaii missile alarm for North Korea or whatever, you know?
So, I mean, is it the case that a prospect can come to you and actually just do this analytics piece without rolling out your base tier? Like, how easy is it for them to grant you access to the data that they need to actually start looking at this stuff? Because I'd imagine this might be you could even sell this as on its own, right? So I'm just wondering, like, how, if it's a big pain in the ass to set up, right, that's one thing. But if it's a few clicks and because it's all cloudy, you know, just grant access here, here, and here and throw it into some analytics. I mean, is that something you're able to do?
Yeah, no, that literally is the base tier. Like, you can't not buy the analytics piece because, like, it's what everything else is downstream of. And so when we do an engagement with a customer, like the first thing that they do, like phase one of our eval, like our evals last like 3 or 4 weeks, depending on like how complicated you want to make them. Phase one is turn it on in read-only mode. And by the second meeting, like look at the house of nightmares and maybe run some SQL queries yourself to see what you can find or questions that you care about or whatever. And then phase two is the like fancy features, the advanced protection stuff that we've talked about before. So like it is just...
So the base tier doesn't actually lock up your mail. It just does the analytics.
Yep. Yeah, the leak prevention feature, for example, is one of our add-ons. Yeah, no, we have three add-ons, like just the leak prevention add-on, the account takeover prevention add-on, and something we call phishing herd immunity. Those are the add-ons. The base tier is what's going on, and like I want to, you know, run a query to show me all the times that this person has phished me in the last 5 years and I didn't catch it. I want to delete emails. Like the simple meat and potatoes visibility and administration stuff is the base. And what I'm blown away by is like some of the really higher end customers that we sell to, the really big complex customers, their first year with us is just in the base tier, you know, because there's like so much
work to do.
It's like foundational, you know. So like it's like really, and then you know we'll even do things like, you know, comp them like a couple hundred seats of all the advanced stuff just so they can try it and whatever and go at their own pace. But like you kind of have to like get the fundamentals, like go and lock down the damn OAuth apps and stuff, you know, before you really start getting really advanced with it. And like I think that feels honest to us. Like we start with fundamentals.
You'd call this like as a product category, you know, you could say it's email security, right? But it's kind of not what we traditionally think of as email security. I think, you know, a term you could use for it is like applied CASB.
Yeah, no, we have what we call the poor man's CASB actually on our homepage, because one of the things that it does with the analytics is it figures out all the apps that are in the environment, not just with like OAuth, but everything you use emails you, right? So if you want to know how many rogue Dropbox accounts are in your environment, and I say this as, you know, an ex-Dropbox employee who still holds Dropbox stock, like you don't have to ask like the network. You don't have to do the reverse proxy thing. And honestly, it's not even going to be an OAuth app because it doesn't need to be. But like Dropbox emails you when you're a user. And so if you can actually parse email and you're pretty smart about it, you can figure out all the things in the environment that are alive just based on what's being emailed. It's like you can build a pretty good CASB just by parsing email. And so we did. It's in the base tier. There's a lot of value in the base tier. Maybe we should charge more for it, but it's the cheapest.
That's really interesting. That's a cool idea. Like, sorting out the, just looking at people's emails and figuring out what they're signed up to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not quite trivial, but like it's not that hard either. It's way easier than pretending you still control the network when everyone's at home. You know?
No one controls the network anymore. And even when they're not
at home,
signed
up on their phone. Good luck.
Network's hard now. All right, Ryan Noon, always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend. And anyone who's interested can go check you out. It's material.security, isn't it?
Yes, the complete vanity.security thing.
All right, so check him out at material.security. Always a pleasure to chat to you, my friend, and all the best with it.
Yep, take care.
That was Ryan Noon there from Material Security in this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that, and thanks to Material for being a Risky Business sponsor. And I gotta say, it is actually a lot of fun having sponsors that are doing things that are genuinely new and interesting. And Material, they definitely tick that box. You can find them at material.security. But that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. I'll be back next week with more security news and analysis. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.